alternate sitting there in the eventuality there are conflicts. These are the things that we, yeah. Mr. Willems.
Chair, just in response to what happens if there's a conflict, then Section 51(2) would kick in, which states that when a member is unable to attend to a matter before a meeting, the alternate steps in. And an alternative to having the alternate stand by for every meeting could be to circulate the pack before the meetings and then for the members to declare any conflicts in order that in the event of a conflict being declared, an alternate can be called in. In that manner, you do not have an alternate that you have to pay for every meeting.
There's a proposal that a pack be circulated before the meeting so that the person will know either whether he attends or he or she attends or recuse based on what will be there. Honorable Humsinga?
Chair, that's fine. Anything is fine as long as it's sort of part of the practicality. So if it's happy with it, it's...
Okay. Can we move to disqualification and removal from membership? That is clause 54, 1, 2, and 3. Honorable Humsinga.
Chair, this is a wording, the disqualification and removal, I would suggest, of membership, not just of membership, but then from the appeals committee. Why membership? Let's be very specific what this is about.
From the appeals. Agreed. Any taker, clause 1, A, B, up to F. Honorable Sibande.
Chairperson, I wanted to clarity with number 1A. If not, is not.
What kind of clarity, honourable member?
I'm coming with it, ma'am.
Okay.
Yes. Chairperson, there is a section of people who are here in South Africa in terms of probation, provisional. Find that the ID, I don't know the new in the cards, but in the previous one, the green barcoded ID, they normally used to say if a person is in probation, waiting, applied for a citizenship of South Africa, maybe the ID will be saying, for an example, he'll say the ID is issued in South Africa, but he'll be saying Swaziland while he's a citizen. That means that person is in probation. So what do we say with those people? Are they also part of this, or what is it? I'm just asking. I'm saying in case of eventuality.
It says a person is not a South African citizen. We've got people who are South Africans, who are having South African ID, but the ID is written non-citizen. Mr. Willems, Advocate Makhato, if you can respond to the Honourable Member.
The intent for the provision is that you must be a South African citizen, not on probation or some other status. You must be fine.
A, are we comfortable? A, B, A, 1A up to F, 2A up to C. And three, Honorable Humsinga, Honorable Ramatlakana, Honorable Siari.
Suggestion, we've just passed under Chapter 8, Appeals Committee, under Section 48, that the Minister must appeal. I would just suggest that we include this section. In other words, alternatives appointed in writing by the Minister according to Section 54, Subsection 1.
Okay. Honorable Ramatlakana.
So mine is a small one on 54.1. The That one, it says the minister may. I think if this particular provision is instructive, it can't be may. It has to be, that has to be the other way. It must be must not, because we're talking about exclusion here. So if you say may, you are leaving it open. So I think it must be must, not appoint a member of this appeal committee if he's not South African. So, yeah.
Must. Okay.
Agreed?
Agreed. Can we go to appeals? That's plus 55. Agreed. Plus 55. Agreed. Agreed to. Honorable Kumsinga.
I'm just at the bottom of 54C. A suggestion that we're also saying that the minister must remove a member or an alternative member of the appeals committee, and then ABC suggestion that the conditions which we just looked at around 53 subsection 2 should be included as a D, because certainly if we say that there are conditions of conflict of interest, that a severity of a certain stage, in other words, not conflict of interest light, the other one, should be grounds to then also remove a member from the committee, which should be added under, as an additional condition, as D.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can we go to appeals 55? Is it gone or still going?
Sure.
Honorable Ramatakana, Honorable Mpanza.
I the sentiment expressed, I think they are good, but I'm just trying to find out the mechanism. Mechanism to determine that leads to this remover. What would that be? Because if you have somebody who has to declare right at the beginning of the meeting, and everybody has to declare that they are not part of it, so how would you come to know? Is this a mechanism of intelligence operative that is going to give the information that what is declared was not necessarily accurate? I'm just trying to find out. I'm not sure. It's too quick for me. I like the idea, but I'm just checking the mechanism that's going to enable this.
But
it suggests that there must be investigation whether the declaration as declared were accurate or not accurate. That's the my difficulty is that is a law of implementability or not, this provision. But I mean, I'm not fighting with that provision, but I'm just saying, yes.
No, Chair, I thought it's a good idea, but I think we will be taking it too much if we then elevate it to that level. I think maybe in the procedure, then that will going to, must also mention some kind of sanction or the process that might be undertaken if a person, because that will be tantamount to dishonest. And then if that happens, then should be then be dealt with a separate process. But I don't think to put it in this under the minister.
Honorable Humsinga.
Thank you, Chair. You might recall that it was a suggestion, in fact, that under 53, subsection 1, 2, that a third one should be considered to explain procedure if conflict of interest arises. So that was said. Then once that procedure, whatever the content would be around that, there must be a distinction between severity, hence my reference to extreme situations of conflict of interest unless, and then if it's found to be extreme, then there must be a sanction to remove a member. So we can't just leave it out, colleague, because then it doesn't make sense to have conflict of interest in at all. So it's in terms of structure, in terms of thinking, that if you want to address conflict of interest, then you must have a particular procedure to handle it, to not just identify it, but also to define it in terms of severity level. And if there is an extreme severity level, then at least you should include that extreme severity under a sanction to remove that member. Otherwise, you can just as well leave it.
Okay. Honorable Mpanza?
No, Chair. We are talking the same language with my colleague. But the point of difference is to use this removal by the minister. I think we agree that there must be some form of sanction, but under the separate procedure or under separate process. That's what I think we differ, but we agree that there must be consequences. It can't be left hanging.
Honorable Siabi.
Chair, when we say the minister will remove a political office bearer, we're referring to, for example, members of the DA.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what we're referring to. That's what we're referring to, Honorable. Yeah. Can we? We are section 55, appeals not taker. Can we move to general provisions? General provisions. Honorable Ramatakana, we're comfortable with our appeals. We move on. Can we move to general provisions?
Honorable Chair, are we dealing with what is here, or are we dealing with other issues that we want to put into this basket? I'll hear from you.
Can we first deal with what is a given, and then we'll add our proposed general provisions? Already there was one which we're carrying on the dependents, and I think it's about two or three general provisions that we're carrying brought forward. Let's start with clause 56, professional and other fees. Agreed?
I think the... this clause, Madam Chair, has to be recast or amended based on what we've discussed before. The whole thing about the consequential aspect of it. You remember we did talk about assistance. So the assistance... this one is almost disclaiming. It's a disclaimer phrase. So it now has to take into account what we've agreed before, as part of what the fund should do. If we agree with that, we're not going to belabor it. I think that's what we need to factor in here. Now I don't know the limitation of that, whether there is a view that in the assistance there should be a listing of the type of assistance, so that it's clear, so that we don't have a speculative view about what assistance means. I would recommend that we at least take time to knowing what the Act deals with. Initially, we dealt with the issue about information, documentation, accuracy, duty of care, the health, the whole bunch, basket of things, that we can list them as this is where the assistance will be required. That's the first point. I want to recommend that we do so. The list may not be exhaustive, but I think the key fundamental where we need to do that, we should do it, which means that there may well be some unknown exclusion. I can't think of any at the moment, but I think that we should be able to do that, Chair. I think it will only be fair that we at least identify clearly here. That's my proposal, Lord. I didn't prepare a list, but the list can be abstracted from some of the duties that is already in the Act of the administrators in the sphere of dealing with the claimant or beneficiary. So that's my suggestion. Maybe the lawyers can also help us to come up with that particular list that is concise. I'm not talking about a two-pager. I'm talking about concise key functions that was a worrying earlier on.
Agreed. Any taker on clause 56? Honorable Musinga?
Chair, I agree with my colleague that we should give the department due time to consider, sort of a layout of all of that. But with your indulgence, Chair, I page over two pages. So if you would allow me to just get back to subsection 2 on the same page, though, 26, just with a question, a remark for consideration. Subsection 2, which is line 3-4, an appeal in terms of subsection 1 must be submitted to the appeals committee within 30 days. Mm. I'm just weighing that off against the fact that the administrator has 180 days. This is just a bit, out of balance, I would say. And if we might be able to settle for the same, consider the same. So that, to lodge an appeal, you have this. I think it should just be fair, both sides.
Within 180 days.
Chair, the department in its responses proposed that this time period be aligned to other legislation where the 180-day period is allowed.
Okay. Clause 57. Liability for administrative decision making. Nothing. Clause 58, restriction on transfer of benefits. Honorable Sibande.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think this one, I'll be satisfied if, only if, it protects people, like what they, during our public hearing, what we got from the people, whereby some of the lawyers, they apply and then they take the money and put them in their own trust fund. But I will accept it if it also protect people against those things. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Clause 58, going. It's gone. Clause 59, service of process commencing litigation. Agreed. Clause 59, clause 60, regulations and certain notices by the minister. Honorable Siabi.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. On the people to be consulted by the minister. H. In consultation with the Minister of Finance, the pre-accident annual income cap. Would that include the tariffs as discussed in the body of the bill?
Mr. Valence?
The tariffs are dealt with under paragraph A. So the consultation would then be with the Minister of Health.
Tariffs and protocols. Honorable Musinga, Honorable Siabi will come back again.
Jay, just so that we're clear what to expect being due to repay for Tuesday. Obviously, the engagement with the Minister of Health would include and cover the contracted service providers. Mm-hmm. But there's also a category which really worried us yesterday of the non-contracted, which obviously is the private sector healthcare. That this consultation and preparation for Tuesday would also include a tariff structure on that.
Honorable Sari, you're fine. We are comfortable with one. Are we okay with two, three, four, up to five? Any takers? It looks like we are okay with 60, all of it. May we move to rules by board, that is 61. 1A up to G, Honorable Ramatlakana.
Can I ask maybe if you could give us some guidance on this, the 56, all of that. Now we're getting into 61. At what stage are we going to talk about what we suggested it should be part of the general provision? After everything, as you run through all of this, or at some point in between?
Earlier on, we had agreed that we will look into what is a given, and then we will come with the proposals that we were making, whether it will be at 56 or whether it will be at 62. It will depend on where we want to put to make the general provisions that we are proposing. If members feel that we've dealt with 59 going into 60, we need to make a submission of our proposal. I think it's also okay if members feel that is how it should be done. No strict rules here.
May I suggest that before we get to the transitional section, we talk about what other areas that you suggested under the general provision before we go to 63.
Okay.
So then we give a notice to the legal eagles to remind us about the section that we have already identified as additional to this.
Okay. We are comfortable with 60. Can we go to 61? Rules by board. Honorable Sithole, Honorable Musinga.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, on number two, rules number two, the board may, by noticing the gazette, but when you go down to number three, the board must. I'm trying to check that may and must.
Okay. Honorable Humsinga.
Just clarity, I would just like to hear the thinking from the department around 64. In other words, 60 subsection 4, which I know we passed, but if you would allow me, Chair, we say that the minister may amend and adjust tariffs. And then mention is made of particular categories, in other words, a particular criteria, it seems. The average annual national income, and the next criteria, the pre-accident annual income cap, and then the funeral benefit referred to in subsection 1. Question, is there a particular formula which sort of is intended here? Because all of that should then, as it says here further, be in relation to the effects of inflation. So what financial mechanisms is intended here, and what elements of the economy would play into this consideration? What is the thinking there in terms of technical financial instruments and indicators that would inform a decision around tariffs, and what would the relationship, while I'm extending it now, if you can just get to that.
Advocate.
Hello. This takes us back to the discussion in the finance chapter and the funding ratio of 90%. You'd recall that the provision there is that if the funding ratio falls below 90%, the minister must, in consultation with the other ministers, make a plan to bring the scheme back into health, or at least he reached the 90% funding ratio. So these adjustments are not those. Those would require most likely legislation to take place. All of the benefits in Chapter 6 provides in the end clause that the minister may from time to time adjust the benefit in line with inflation. So these are then the implementation provisions that allows the minister from time to time to upwards adjust benefits. And as it states here, it's informed by inflation. It's an inflationary adjustment, and when it's affordable to the scheme, there's an inflationary adjustment, there's a notice to the public to say, all right, your benefits are now going up. I'm not sure if I've answered the question.
Honorable Msinga, are you comfortable? Honorable Ramatlaka?
Comfortable. But maybe the Mr. Willems, I like the explanation. In fact, the emphasis that you make, that this is upwards attention here. That upwards, I would have loved to see that word somewhere in this provision, if you could please put it in, the meaning of this, because it can be, I don't want, you must go look for legal opinion about it. Let's just be explicit about what it means, borrowing that ambiguity is not a good thing. Okay, I agree with
you. Okay. Can we look, Honorable?
We're 61, right?
Yes. We're going to 62. Okay. Are you taking anything? Is there a taker on 61?
We're redirected to 62.
Rerouted.
Let me just be kind.
The GPS was rerouted.
Chair, the D, 61-1D, this is about the rules, making the rules. What is the D speaks to? If you can just help me to understand it.
For the
Continue.
For the administrator to be liable or to be in a position to start paying a benefit, it must establish that the injury or death is causally related to a road accident or accident involving a motor vehicle. So the rules will provide a procedure or a list in terms of how that is established. So from a claims perspective, certain documents or affidavits need to be there to state that my injury was sustained in a motor vehicle accident. Consequently, you then have nexus established and you can move on to determining the benefit or the income. So there needs to be forms and rules to say how you go about doing this. How do you establish this?
Okay. Can we move on? Honorable Sithole?
Okay.
Can we move on?
You're not paying attention.
Can we go to offences, that is 62?
Can I just...
Oh, must and may.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
So, subsection 2 refers to an instance where the board, once they've developed training programs for assessors, may. So, it's an election left open to the board. It's not a requirement for the scheme to operate for this to be there. Whereas, must is a requirement for the board in terms of in 3, it must follow that PAJA process in terms of giving notice and commenting.
Are you happy, Honourable Member? Can we proceed to 62 offences? Honourable Sibande?
Chairperson, in 1, line 40, I'm not satisfied about this. The imprisonment of notices in 3 months. A lot of people, to avoid the conman, I think the sentence must be improved then. And then also, the second one, the imprisonment of 3 years also, I'm not satisfied. Also, to do an introspection, I think it falls under the category of justice. I don't know what is the relationship between this and the idea of justice in terms of sentencing. Just need a clarity. But to me, I'm not satisfied. The period is not enough. 3 months is not enough.
Honorable Humsinga.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry to go back again. I didn't forgotten word that you, but section 61, the very last sentence, 35, there's a behind the comma section which says that must allow 30 days for submission of comments unless it is impractical to do so. Not acceptable. I would submit that that must come out. You must publish it, it can't be optional, and it can't ever be impractical, because then we must add it to everywhere where it says you must publish it.
Agreed. Mr. Willemse, Advocate Makhato.
Chairperson, you will recall that we responded to that. You said, maybe let me leave it at that. But then this question was responded to.
Honorable Ramatlakane.
It was my question, and indeed it was responded to about you may find that you have to shorten the period. I think Mr. Velamso did answer that question. But I did then say that we will speak to it when we get to it. That was also said. For a completion of this.
Now is that time
that we need to deal with that. So, yeah, no, I just want to put it in a proper context. No, Chair. I don't understand that rider. I honestly don't understand it. The simple thing is that there is 30 days.
Yeah.
Let's just agree on 30 days. Let's not have some creeping stuff. Because it's administrative stuff that you need to consult with. So let's just be simple as that. That's 30 days for comment. And then we make a full stop after comment, and that's it. Administrators will have to be on their toes to do to make sure that, because this work is going to be done by the administrators, and the board is only just simply to say, we agree with it, this is what, let's publish it. Okay, that's my point.
62, it's a given. 62, can we look at offenses? We're done submission of such comment, full stop. The staff writing of unless it is impractical, we're not going to allow it. Anything on 62? You had already started on clause 2 or subsection 2. Okay. Anything on 62? Yes, I'm coming back. I wanted to check if there was other members who wanted to say something on offences. Nothing. Honourable Humsinga. Honourable Humsinga.
So I'm just considering section 62 in light of section 45. And looking at the reason for imposing a fine there, and I'm trying to get my head around that. So if I could leave it with that in asking for insight into situations, because if a person after a subpoena has been submitted does not comply, I mean, how would it be detrimental to the scheme, which would justify urgency under the threat of a fine, because it would be to the benefit of the scheme since the case wouldn't move. So is this another way of funding the scheme, or how must I understand this? If you could just explain that, please.
Advocate Makhato.
A no, it's not. This money is not going to go to the scheme chairperson. It's a fine that will be imposed. There was a question that was posed by the honourable member that the 3 months is not enough. So may I humbly get a suggestion from the committee.
Imprisonment, 3 years. Honorable Sibande, you said 3 years imprisonment is not enough. When you were wanting to make a proposal, then you will have to respond to also, yeah. Honorable Sibande.
So that we scare the people who are taking chances, why don't we say the first one, one, instead of 3 months, we say 6 months. And then the other one, number two, instead of 3 years, we make it 5 years.
Advocate and your tip.
Sorry, before you respond, man, you see, it's a person what I'm scared of. You know, people sometimes are taking an advantage with our laws. You give a person 3 months, and then they get a remission. That means you will stay 1 month, and then after that, it's out. And then also those with 3 years, you will stay there about a year, and then after, it's released. You get the parole. I thought that some of the, when we're dealing with this subject, we must think about the issue of the parole as well. Because you may not know, and they are not going to consult us who take that decision of a punishment. They will just give them a parole. So it's better to give a little bit years so that when they get the parole, at least they will be, I mean, half of that period will be done. Thank you, Chairperson.
Advocate and your team.
Okay, Chairperson, the proposed amendments are welcomed and they've been noted.
Okay. Anything on offences? Can we move? Honourable Humsinga?
Chair, I'm still trying to understand why this is necessary, because I'm arguing that if a subpoena has been submitted and a person doesn't react, then the claim sort of is pending. So, you know, what's the reason for, you know, behind this sentence and fine and all of this? I just want to get the thinking behind it.
Chair, a claim may be submitted, processed and paid, and the payment happens on an incremental basis. Monthly there's a payment made. Someone comes with information to the administrator that says this person got involved in an altercation in a bar. He's drafted an affidavit and said it was a hit and run and you've been paying him for the last 5 years. This person may not want to come to the administrator to give the evidence. So there needs to be a penalty involved.
Okay. Understood. Within that context, offences going gone. Honourable Ramatakan, you wanted to deal with the other matters before we go into transitional provisions and savings. It's your turn now, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am looking around because earlier on we did say that we need to add certain particular clauses, and I thought that there were some notes that were kept for that. If we could ask that we are reminded, you know that we did say under this we need this clause and that and clause to be added.
Advocate.
Chair, it was part E. The members felt that should be added under general provisions. That is the clause that deals with benefit review. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Ramachaka.
Chair, we did say the automatic one that we need to put it in terms of the general. What else? I mean, is that all?
It was assist team. Alma, Dr. Ngezi, are there other things that we... I think there were...
Let me just say the new ones. Maybe we're going to put them under transition.
Okay.
There is a debate that we had earlier on about this. When is this other act going to repeal the other act? And we did not say anything. There was also another discussion that we had about the fact that the issue about the marriage between road accident fund and the social security system must meet somewhere. So in terms of what this act is talking about is anticipating that situation. So for me, Chair, I think we will need to have another provision that speaks specifically about the fact, I would say, for an example, 2028, that we should have the Department of Social Security that deals that aspect should then look at coming up with the act that is going to enable the current two-tier system on the Social Security as spoken about to Mary. So that's the responsibility that happened on that. Otherwise, we don't put that time frame. We will have the debate and not actually have the period on which we can say now, in fact, this the fear that we have in terms of if this meets, there will be a problem. So that's the first provision I think we need to be saying that in 10 years, we should have a social development coming up with the act that makes sure that these two merit, that we really realize the social security system in a country as announced by the Constitutional Court and when they were making certain rulings. That's one. Two, it's another recommendation that we need to have. We already said in earlier discussion when we're dealing with the funding that the funding is not limited, in our view, it's not limited to the levy only. There has to be a provision made to fund these. If it's a special tax, then that department, national department, treasury will have to come up with that. Because otherwise we're going to have be trapped into the situation that is untenable. That is, I think we need to make sure that also gets into this. Now, with that provision, with that amendment in mind, it means we can never run the two systems to infinity. We need to put a date when this must end, and then we run with one system. That means funding has to be looked into to deal with this backlog that you have, that you can't run that backlog for years. The view that I hold is that if we have an NDP with the outlook of 2030, the NDP 2030 should be the marker that this one that we are dragging along should end. 2030, the provision that we must put in here is that by 2030, we would have dealt with all the backlog that you're talking about. We would have the Treasury would have looked at additional tax, I don't know what type of tax, in terms of funding this benefit. And the other one will then cease to exist. That's the outlook in terms of the additional provision we need to put into the general provision that we did mention earlier on. That's, let me pause the chair.
Okay. Honorable Siari, you had your hand up earlier. Okay. Any taker? Honorable Humsinga?
Thank you, Chair. I go along with what my colleague suggested, and I would recommend to them as that Table 3 of the True South Report be recognized in this instance, suggesting a targeted date around 2025, 26, but I go along with what my colleague then suggests with 2030 as a target date coinciding with what he explained.
Can we now anything from the department?
Chair, I just need to make a few comments in relation to the sunset clause. So currently, the Road Accident Fund has settled claims with a number of claimants, and so that settlement takes the form of a cash lump sum payment, which it got. But then we also issue undertaking certificates. The undertaking certificate takes two forms. It's either contractual or there's a provision for one provided in legislation. And it states that for the duration of your life, the Road Accident Fund will pay medical treatment required in relation to injury sustained in a road accident. So there's a liability created. That liability is part of the 200 billion deficit that we have. in addition to claims that have not yet been lodged and not settled by the Road Accident Fund. Now, from a legal perspective, those people have got vested rights. So, and the rights vest at the time that either there's the settlement that you enter into or when there's an accident. And the rights are informed by the legislation in place at that point in time, which is the Road Accident Fund Act. So accidents that occurs before this act becomes law then creates these vested rights for a class of claimants, various classes of claimants. In our law, I would propose to that you have to sustain legal advice from your advisors in terms of the constitutionality, because it's frowned upon to go back and remove vested rights, which is, if I understand the sunset clause, is what you intend to do.
Okay. Honorable Ramachakan.
I think the thing that we're talking about and the suggestion that we have here, why are we coming with this legislation in the first place? If the reason that we come up with this legislation is that we need to get somewhere where we're going to have to stop and start something new, then we have this legislation. So I think, Chair, therefore, that what the proposal is informed by exactly that objective. We can get the legal opinion, but I don't know what the vested rights and all the people who believe. It's not suggested that those because are going to be repealed. If you have an agreement that you have been paid, you have an agreement you are going to be paid, exist, is recognized, because you don't have a retrospective here. So that happens. But the question that we're talking about here is, when do you stop running to act? Now, this where this thing about 2030 comes in. Because, and that the rights that people have accumulated and the benefit are not necessarily going to be repealed by the fact of the matter, because you are paying them anyway. Some of them have their bank money in a bank. Some of them, they've got a promissory note. You've given them that we will pay you this thing once you have the money. So you have that liability. But the issue that we're raising here is, when do we have one act? That's the thing, because all of the things that are moving from the new will now be taken care of this, the new act. All what you are dragging is the cost factor, which the Treasury must deal with that particular issue about the backlog issue, which is going to be lesser and lesser as we move into the future, because you're going to use two different systems altogether, unless you say no. You're going to continue to use the old system of Lamsa, then it's a different case altogether. So what are we talking about?
It may be good to use an example. So if this act comes into force tomorrow, and I'm involved in a road accident today, and I'm a paraplegic, a serious injury, it means that under the current law, I have a claim that would entitle me to a substantial amount of money for general damages, because that's the law as it stands today. Someone that's injured in the same motor vehicle accident tomorrow with the same injuries would get a different set of benefits. One of them would not be general damages. I'm also entitled to a lump sum payment, my full capital payment within the current dispensation, which it comes with all the problems, and that's the reason why I'm mending. But those are the rights that I then have as a claimant today. So how this transitional arrangement works is that tomorrow, when the new administrator comes into being, the legal entity, the current Road Accident Fund legal entity falls away. But in order to administer these claims, you cannot repeal the Road Accident Fund Act. You need that legislation because that informs your liability to these people. So that act then remains in place without the Road Accident Fund. It's now that legislation is just now administered by the new administrator, and you'll have these classes of claimants, those with claims that arose prior to and those that arose under the new legislation. If at a certain point in time, let's assume 2028 as suggested, you want to repeal the Road Accident Fund legislation, the Act, it means that framework that you then still, that informs the rights of certain individuals is repealed. They have no right. They then, in common law, can pursue, I suppose, the wrongdoer. The point, but the challenges would be that prescription would have met many of those claims. So what, and this arrangement is not strange. I can just read to you section 2 of the current Road Accident Fund. The Road Accident Fund replaced the Multilateral Motor Vehicle Accident Fund, the legal entity that existed before. And it states that subject to section 28, the Multilateral Motor Vehicle Accident Fund established by the agreement concluded between the contracting parties shall cease to exist. And all money credited to that fund immediately before the commencement of this act shall vest in the fund and all assets, liabilities, rights and obligations existing as well as accruing of the first mentioned fund shall devolve on the fund, meaning the Road Accident Fund. And any reference in any law or document to the said Multilateral Motor Vehicle Accident Fund shall, unless clearly inappropriate, be construed as a reference to the new fund, the RAF. What that means is the current RAF, when it came into being, administered claims under the Multilateral Motor Vehicle Accident Fund Act. We actually still, until recently, had such claims which we dealt with. And the reason that this is there is for the fact that you're dealing with vested rights. And you cannot, at a certain point in time, remove those vested rights. You need to deal with it in the new dispensation. So the transitional clause in the bill provides for this.
I think I am listening, but it's not my subject. It's a subject for all of us.
Yes.
Currently, you will be paying people lump sum. Once you have the money, those that are lump sum is due to them, you pay them. And your liability insofar as them that you remain on your book is a health issue, maintenance, and their medications. All right? That's what you do. So even when we in fact pass this legislation, that obligation will remain with you, right? So now, why then, if that's the case, you don't have a provision here that recognizes that fact, so that when you actually repeal that other act, everything is consolidated under one act?
Mr. Willemsen?
Sure. Yes. It is the challenge is you cannot consolidate it under this Act because the benefits that you provide under the two laws are different. And it is provided in the transitional provision. Provision is made for the fact that the legal entity as the RAF dies off and that the new administrator then continues. It takes on its books the $200 billion that it owes, which it comprises of claim payments, settled claims which it must pay, claims that have occurred but where the claim has not yet been lodged with the Road Accident Fund. So those are claimants where we have not signed that agreement to take care of your future costs. We've not paid them yet. The claim must first be lodged. We cannot preempt that. In terms of the current dispensation, we cannot tell the person when to lodge. So when those claims come in, you need to administer them in terms of an act. And that will be the Road Accident Fund Act with minor amendments in terms of who now administers it. It's no longer the Road Accident Fund. It is now the administrator. Over time, because no new claims will arise under that legislation once this act becomes law, those claims will be extinguished over time, except for those instances where you've contractually agreed, either through a statutory undertaking or a contractual undertaking with a claimant, that until you die, you're entitled to these services from the Road Accident Fund at the time, but those rights and obligations now devolve on the new administrator. So for decades, the new administrator would have to honor the rights that exist currently for claimants who have already lodged and finalized their claims with us. In addition to that, new claims that are lodged even after the new administrator is established, but where the claim arose prior to that date. Because remember, now we talked about prescription. If you have a claim for a minor, that minor has any, well, in extreme cases, you could have a one-year-old that has 17 years plus another 3 years before he lodges a claim. So it could be a very long end before you actually receive a claim. There are very few of those, but the point of the matter is accidents that happened 10 years ago, there may be accidents that happened 10 years ago where we still have not received those claims. They will still flow to us. And when they do, you need to administer them in terms of a law. And the current law is the Road Accident Fund Act. If that act is removed at a point in time, those claimants' rights are removed, and there's a potential that you can argue that they now have a common law claim, a delictual claim against the wrongdoer.
Okay. Honorable, I think it's understood. Can we go into clause 63? Honorable Ramatlakane has highlighted several things, and I hope the legal team has picked those ones up, which actually will form part of the things that we are proposing. Let's look at clause 63. Agreed? Honorable Humsinga.
Chair, I just want to also understand now, in addition to what you've just explained, Mr. Willemse, how would the claims that are prescribed in the meantime be handled?
Mr. Willemse?
There's currently a law in place. When the new act comes into force, there will be a new law in place. There's no gap. There's no lacuna. It's a seamless transition at a certain point in time when a new law is promulgated. If your claim prescribed under the current legislation, it has prescribed. It would not revive under the new act. There's a set of rules that apply to causes of action that arise before the new act comes into force. That set of rules is the current legislation. When the accident takes place on a date after the new act has come into force, a new set of rules attach to those claims. So the fact that the new act comes into force has no bearing on the rights that are vested under the Road Accident Fund Act.
Honorable Mutsinga.
And if those claims have prescribed due to the actions of the Road Accident Fund?
Maybe it will assist if I read the policy, the section in the Act. So if you look at 63.2b, the Road Accident Fund ceases to exist, and all its assets, liabilities, rights and obligations existing as well as accruing devolve upon the administrator, including all contractual rights, obligations, and liabilities. The fund has in place policies that creates a right for a claimant where we, as the Road Accident Fund, is responsible for the claim prescribing. So that right will follow.
Are you happy, Honorable Humsinga? Anything again on transitional provisions? Honorable Humsinga?
Jam, if I talk about prescribed or claims, I'm talking of direct claims that I have prescribed under RAF.
Just
in response to that, we have a policy in the Road Accident Fund to assist claimants where a claim is prescribed due to our breach of duty of care. That breach of duty of care creates a right. If you look at section 63.2 subparagraph B, That right, the counter side of a right, is an obligation. That obligation that then is rested on the fund follows us into RABS. The new administrator will honor that obligation.
Okay. Now it's clear. It got me. Honorable Ramatlakana.
Chair, I just want to find out if you can please remind us. Did you not also mention a clause, a new clause that deals with the mediation somewhere?
We spoke about it and said that we will have to do something about it when we arrive.
Which sections are we referring to here? Is it under the general provision or is it under transition? Is it general provision?
It's general provisions.
Okay.
It's general provisions where we will have something that has to do with mediation. Anything still on 63? Going. It looks like it's gone. Insertion of Section A1 in Act 56 of 1996. That's TOS 64, application of the Act. That's Road Accident Fund. Anything to say on A1? Anything to say on A1? Thank you. Section 65. The following section is hereby substituted for Section 5 of the Road Accident Fund Act of 1996. Financing of the fund, 5A, the administrator. Establish the Road Accident Benefits Scheme Act 2017, shall procure the funds it requires to perform the functions from any levy provided by or in terms of the Custom and Excise Act of 1964, Act 91 of 1964, and any monies as may be appropriated by Parliament as contemplated in Section 26 of that Act. Can we agree, pass? Any inputs? Honorable Sibande.
Jefferson, I just want to ask a clarity. Because somewhere, when we spoke about financing in terms of funds, we spoke about that the minister, in consultation with the Minister of Treasury. And then I wanted to get maybe a clarity what is, because to me that is a contradiction now. Because previously we said the money is going to be acquired by the minister, including the Minister of Treasury. But here we're saying administrator or whatever. May I have a clarity?
Chair, this will be a consequential change required, considering the substantial changes to the finance chapter.
Okay. Agreed to. Can we agree to clause 65? Any other matter on clause 65? Silence is golden. Can we move to the short title? Akbare Leaders, agreed to. Can we go to the schedules? Can we move to the schedules, honorable members? Oh, 10 minutes break is proposed. 5 minutes break is proposed. Hello. Yes, ma'am. Okay. I beg your pardon, ma'am? Yes, earlier on in the morning I came to because they had indicated that the results will be out today, and then they said the doctor will be able to call and indicate whatever is needed. Yes. Okay. Okay. He's much better, but he still has got some constipation. Okay. Thank you very much, doctor. Bye. Honorable members, yebo. Oh, ay, tas hita uma kale I ungata uta I joina I yale a leshwani a ya a
I got it. references from the kind. I had a question.
Remember that I don't dare because no, that time because I was hoping it was gonna move like that, but there was no movement, which is why I kept on pressing back and forth.
You press. Now you're gonna pause it.
Mhm. See, it was not moving.
Then it's moving.
Okay. Oh, now it is. Okay.
Are there takers on the first schedule, temporary support benefit formula? Akbar Lieder? Honorable Ramachakana, are you talking? Page 30. Honorable Humsinga.
Can I must talk, Chair? Thank you, Chair. I would like to know, Chair, in the formula which then pertains to temporary income support benefit formula, you would notice the 75%, where the 75% comes from. Because in essence, Chair, it means that under normal conditions, 100% benefit would be eligible to the claimant, since proof has to be provided of 100% of income, which this then seeks to replace. Because if this is a social support benefit scheme, it then seeks to replace the loss of a particular claimant. So I don't understand why this victim then stands to lose 25% on the basis of a formula whereby he has to provide proof of a full income. So where does this discount or deduction come in, and why the particular number of 75?
Chair, the Satchel report has informed the policy that was developed and adopted by Cabinet, which informed the legislation. The Satchel Commission looked at social security schemes and certain principles, and it stated in that report that the full compensation shouldn't be paid, but a factor should be used. Now, the rationale behind the factor is firstly just to clarify, because a number of persons have referred to this as it's a reduction for income tax. It's not the case. The factor allows for the fact that, one, a person staying at home incurs less overheads. Secondly, it's an incentive to return to work. If you pay a flat rate, many people would make no effort to be rehabilitated and go back to work. And then thirdly, the rationale is, as stated, it's also an insurance principle not to pay out the full loss.
Chair, I would submit that the Satchel Commission did not recommend 75%. And I would maintain that the Satchel Commission recommended 80%. Therefore, there's no particular guideline. And I would then ask this committee's consideration for 100%. Because if the administrator requires someone to provide proof of 100% of income together with his or her claim, surely it should be acknowledged that that full amount needs to be compensated for. Elements and aspects that you have less overheads if you stay at home, etc., etc., doesn't weigh up to the fact that this is called a social responsibility benefit, and that we undertake a particular standard in terms of replacement of income,
and therefore I cannot go along with a deduction of 25%. That's a quarter of the income which the family was used to, or the individual was used to. So I don't understand the rationale for the deduction of 25%.
Honorable Ramatlaka.
No, Chair, I the best way to deal with the, because I think there seems to be disagreement of facts. What are the facts? Is it that the Federal Commission spoke about 75? That's easy to prove, because Federal Commissions, we can prove that quite easily, and then then determine from there whether, in our view, the calculation as it stands of the 75%, depending on the year and depending on how many years and the days, is what we want to go with in terms of the formula here. So that I think we will discuss the principle of that, not so much about the calculation of it. You remember we had a discussion earlier about what is the funding, is it 90%, or what percentage is it? I think we had earlier on had that discussion. So perhaps, Chair, the best way to deal with this, because it is, if we understand one part, which is a principle, whether it's a short term, long term, the principle will be the same in terms of the long term. So if we can get clarity around that, and then we move from that, if it's at 80%, is it 80%? And if it's 80%, and then we'll then ask, what substantiated to increase it to a 7% to bring down by another 5%, then see whether we agree with that and then make that principle determination, and then we move to the next section. I think that's probably my take on it, because there is a rationale. The rationale that has been presented is that the three things that has been mentioned is the no cost if you are at home, and the other one that is mentioned is incentive, that you don't have 100%. The incentive is to, when you are recovered, to go back, and the one thing being the insurance. I think if we understand that, it will be easy for us to crack the discussion. That is my suggestion. If we can just get the facts, and then once we have all the facts on the table, then we deal with that in that way.
Honorable Humsinga.
Thank you, Chair. I absolutely go along with the recommendation of my colleague. And if I can help you in terms of the Satchel Commission, paragraph 32.154, income support benefits shall be payable to earners in the amount of 80%. Of their net after-tax pre-accident income, subject to the monetary ceiling.
Chair,
yes.
In explaining the 75%, I said the principle derives from the Satchel Commission, which was taken up in a policy which was approved by Cabinet, and Cabinet thought it appropriate to reduce the 80% to 75%, and that has found its way into legislation and the bill that's before us today. So the principle of applying a factor to the benefit derives from the Satchel report.
Can we agree with the proposal that was made by Honorable Ramatlakana? Can we move, that was the temporary income support benefit formula. Honorable Sibanda, Honorable Humsinga, Honorable Sibanda, did you have your hand up?
No.
Okay. Honorable Humsinga.
Thank you, Chair. Also, just the X element in the formula, then as a cover up of a B section, which is very specific in terms of what should compromise X in the formula, the amount determined in accordance with subsection 35, subsection 5A, and then an all-covering B section, or as the case may be, which is also, which is not acceptable, Chair. It's, a formula is there to be specific. If, as the case may be, if that refers to 35.5 subsection A, then the reference to 35 sub 5A is sufficient. I don't understand the addition and the cover in a B section stating as the case may be, because it just opens up any other element, it seems, if X could not be determined.
Which is which?
So what I'm suggesting, Chair, is that that B part should be left out. We either work on subsection 35 sub 5A as the prime source that would determine X and nothing more.
Mr.
Valens? Chair, the difference between A and B is A is your proven income as allowed for in that section. B is the deemed income. So if you're one of those categories of persons who are unemployed and an income is deemed for you, that would be B.
Chair, then I suggest we specify so. And we can differentiate between deemed and calculated.
So we must deal with as the case may be. It becomes specified because the amount used with accordance to subsection 35.5A is stipulated, and can we also indicate the B as the case may be, we're able to indicate the issues that we are raising. Honorable
Ramatlakane. No, Chair. My point is that I am moving from the wording that it is precisely in the bill as it stands.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to page 17 and you go an I on the top of that page, you see identical wording to the formula and what is contained in that section, particularly around the long term. So it's a copied out of the shorthand at the back to the long sentence in front. I think the difficulty, you have it.
Proof of the injured person's pre-accident income.
Yes, you see that.
Okay.
Section 35.2A or B, as the case may be, you see that wording.
Mm-hmm.
Same wording that is at the back. So the challenge that we have is that if we don't know who the victim of a road accident would be, and we may assume that it's going to affect the A part, and in that case the A part is someone who can prove a kind of income, but if we don't know that person doesn't have any employment, then it's covered under B. So then we will exclude, if we agree with that section, we'll then exclude whole lot of people, and particularly those are poor people that would have been affected by that kind of section. My plea, Chair, is that perhaps we, understanding the challenges that we have, we accept this A and B. In principle, I think we have to accept it. And I think we did also talk about the definition of average somehow or somewhere else in the document, which was something that was addressing the problem of unknown in terms of if somebody can't prove, then you've got to take the average as is utilized. So I think I would agree that, Chair, we should go ahead with what we have here. It's consistent with what we had in the definition, consistent with what we've discussed earlier in terms of the two type of problems that we are confronted with, particularly around the road accident.
Agreed. Can we go to long-term income support benefit formula? Okay.
Chair, if I could just a last comment on the previous formula, in terms of B, people that do not have a formal income must absolutely be accommodated. There shouldn't be any doubt about that. But then in an unformulated way, and then not on condition that the minister can decide what that amount is, because if you then look at the section which you referred to, correctly referred to, colleague, 35 subsection 5A, there you would see the wording that it's dependent on the determination of a pre-accidental annual income cap, which if you would get to look under definitions, well, in that specific section you see that it is subject to just a bit lower, conditions 1 and conditions 2. And that should be read in conjunction with all three those levels of determination, because then in terms of the definition and referring back to that particular section, you would see that it's that it can be determined that it's far more flexible. And I'm arguing that that flexibility would not be pro poor, and that we would just have to look at all three those elements. And in principle, we do accept, and I'm absolutely in agreement to that. But those three elements need to be put next to each other, and surely we can look at it again or ask the department just to look at it with those three elements next to each other and open the option of looking at it again.
We're probably saying the same thing. The one thing that, remember that we have part of this bill which is informed by the original bill that was presented to us. Subsequent to that, there has been insertion of a definition. Now, the minister can't go against the definition. Whatever methodology and the formula that is going to be utilized, it will be informed by the definition as we agreed to in terms of addressing that the B part. So if anything that is here, that's the thing that we need to fix in terms of the cleaning up the consequential part of the bill, which is not necessarily addressed in terms of the earlier average part. So I would think that we both agree that we should proceed on the basis of what we've already agreed in the front.
Okay. Agreed to? Where are we now? Formula 2. We are now in Formula 2, long-term income support benefit formula. It's the same thing. Agreed to? Honorable Humsinga?
Thank you, Chair. Indeed, that's also subject to, not just because we see the 75% there, but here again we should look at Section 36, Subsection 5, Sub A, because there we said that other income which is generated should be taken in account and therefore deducted, as what the formula suggests with determining the value Z, which I cannot go along with, and we would submit that residual earnings shouldn't be a penalty. If a person, through his own action, in addition, earns, that should be incentivized. It shouldn't be penalized, because what you just said, Mr. Willemse, is that 75% as a formula is used because a person would stay at home and would, by implication, through your assumption as you expressed it, find no effort necessary to find another income. Now, in those circumstances, there might be an effort to find an additional income, and then you penalize it in that you want to deduct it from the benefit, which I find unfair, Chair.
Honorable Ramatlaka.
If I remember, yesterday we had a discussion on the similar provision, and that similarity was that in that case it was a protection from the fund that we don't want to be presented with a bank statement. As a way to ask that, look, you must match my bank statement. And then because the bank statement would be inflated by other sources of income. And therefore, there was a clear stipulation that said that would be excluded. And there was a word that was used, I think, illegal. I can't remember what it was termed illegal income. Eh?
It was illegal income or something, if I recall.
Yeah, it was called illegal income, and then there was a long debate about that. So I think the for consistency part, and I don't read this as that is going to be penalized. I could just read it as the original and what we've discussed. In fact, we agreed with the formulation in the earlier section that should not be the case. That it's your protection is justified. We agreed with that. Now, similarly, the in this side, I mean, how do you minus or deduction on something that is as a result of the selling of Fed Cooks? Mm-hmm. Selling a Maguinya does not influence what it can be proven as an income, because that is the methodology of proving that is different than selling Omakui. So bank statement here is not going to be, I don't think it should penalize if there is intention to. So maybe that's what advocate can help us to understand whether that's the intention, because if it is intention, that we probably have to fix it to align it with the same principle of your own protection. That protection must also equally be applicable to the victims, if there's victims that have an income in that sense.
Agreed. Mr. Valencia?
This Z doesn't apply to the illegal income issue. What's intended here is that at some point the person is going to be able to return to work, some of them, and as they progressively work, the loss that they had initially incurred is eroded through the fact that they're receiving an income. So you could reduce a benefit. Someone who's made a full loss, who sits at home, who cannot go back to work, gets a benefit. But let's assume they enter the labor market and they start earning again. You're not going to pay them at that same loss, because there's also an income happening. So it balances out over time. That's the one example. The other example is you've got someone that's involved in a crash that has multiple income streams. You own two buildings, for instance, you're a landlord. You receive income and you are injured in a road crash. You prove the income to the administrator. This is what you would have earned. Your needs have not been affected in the sense that you're not left without an income because of the crash. There's still income that you receive. So there is no need to substitute something that you haven't lost. So that's what the Z in the formula deals with.
If you read your definition of the long term, it suggests that the long term is a long term. Right. Now you are now interchangeably speaking to long term and a short term. Mm. Because the short term, one would understand the short term, that it's going to affect, because the short term, this person is going to have to go back to work at a particular time, and if that the injury has been sorted out, that person will go back to work, and that will affect the benefit because this was a short term. But the long term means perhaps there's been amputation of two legs. So the Z, how does the Z apply to that? Because that means that it's a long term. So I think maybe what we need to do is to fix that so that what you're talking short term, I would say the Z would then applicable in the short term, the Z in terms of what happened. The long term, if it's a long term and it's determined, then it's a long term, it means forever that this person will be, reduced to be on a wheelchair. And therefore, the Z does not apply to that particular person. Unless we're clutching the straws on the long and short term.
Mr. Valencia?
Chair, the benefits are designed that the short term is defined as the temporary income support benefit, which is a period of 2 years calculated from the date of accident. So that's the temporary should be read as the short term. This long-term benefit only kicks in after the initial two-year period. It then becomes, it is then the long-term benefit. So the thinking in terms of the development of this was that for a short term, it wouldn't impact hugely. And even in terms of the medical reports that are required in the shorter term, it's seen that you've got to provide a medical certificate to say this person is unable to return to work. Regardless of residual income, you're going to then pay a benefit. From after the first initial two-year period, this longer-term benefit kicks in. And if this person then starts, now in terms of the current formulation, it becomes relevant. If there is other income flowing to this person, and considering that this benefit will be paid up until age 60, for instance, it has a considerable potential impact on the scheme in terms of finances. So if you don't allow for additional income, you may have persons, and remember this only impacts someone that does have that additional income stream. So if you may have persons that get the benefit, but also are in a position now to start getting other employment and other forms of income. If you don't adjust your benefit accordingly, why are you paying them still? Because they could be rehabilitated. I want to use the example that you had used of someone who had an amputation of both legs. Sure, the person might have proven a loss in his pre-accident life of X, get rehabilitated and find other employment that potentially gives him more of an income that he had, because disability nowadays doesn't mean that you necessarily won't have an income. Or through the vocational ability benefit that's provided in the bill, you could be trained or skilled and get a call center job or whatever what new employment is, that your employment compared after accident versus before, you might be financially better off afterwards. So that Z takes into account the progression over time if you do enter into employment again.
Honorable Ramachakan.
Okay, Chair, I hear that, but... So is the explanation means that the Z is properly placed on the long term. So we should leave it on the long term. What's your put differently? How many cases have you dealt with in this way?
None, for the reason that currently there is no vocational ability assessment or benefit in the road accident fund. We pay a lump sum at a certain point in time. We do not get to track or assist someone to be rehabilitated or enter the employment market.
I think that then, Chair, I think answered the question that perhaps this. It's something that we will experience as we progress into the implementation part. It's some of the unknown factors that will still have to be seen. But the important thing is that the kick-in clause only is applicable once the person has been rehabilitated and is able to earn income. I think that's that's a comforting part for me. So I think we should accept that explanation.
Any takers still on long term? Can we move to family support benefit? Family support benefit, Honorable Homsinga, Honorable Sibande.
Chairperson, with this one, I think also it's considering the issue of consistency, as the previous discussion on page 19. And then also, I think it doesn't discriminate, because our problem was that in terms of the payments, if it's discriminating, that's why we're having a serious problems. But this one doesn't discriminate. And I believe that this is a shorthand of the other party. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Sibande. Honorable Homsinga.
Thank you, Chair. We're dealing with family benefits now.
Yes.
And in principle, the family benefits seem to be a deduction of the breadwinner's, the remaining spouse's income, deducted off the breadwinner's income. But in both cases, it's not the gross income which is used as a calculator. It's the after-tax, the net calculation which is used, which I would like to get explained. You wouldn't see the reference to that year. You would see it in the definition, which is under 38 subsection 5, where it says that the amount that would be used there would be a after-tax, in other words, less tax amount. In other words, a net income, not a gross income. So I would want to hear the justification for that. And furthermore, I do notice there that there's a 2 divided by 4, which in essence is 0.5. So why is it halved? On both sides. So if you use any number as an example, even your own, because I think what we envisage in being something that would replace a benefit for someone else, it really hits the heart if you do the calculation on your own circumstances. And having your income halved and to suddenly start off with a base of an after-tax calculation, which means your after-tax income is halved in terms of the principal number that you calculate with, and then you deduct the two from one another. So why is the wife's income used to, as a factor, further divide the potential income in the absence of a breadwinner to the benefit intended for the family? So I would like to get clearance on the fact that after tax, in other words, why isn't gross income used? And furthermore, why do you half and then half both salaries to determine the family benefit for the remaining spouse and for the kids?
Why the wife and not the husband? Honorable Ramatlaka.
No, Chair. I'm not answering that question, Chair.
Which one?
The one that you opposed. I thought that Honorable Singer will answer that for himself. I thought that in the main document, particularly in the document that had a joint venture between transport and treasury, this particular issue here was fleshed out. And if you read the document, the actual document, the bill, again you see some consistency.
Page?
The page is section 38, section 38.5, sub 5. And you read here, there's some consistency with that, because this is a shorthand. And there was a reason that was given yesterday when we were discussing the issue about another section, the section, I think it was 40, where we had long debate about why would this happen, why this benefit, why the E. Today we have suggested an amendment that has an automatic clause. And the explanation yesterday that was given was that once the beneficiary X no longer exists, then there is a family benefit that kicks in, which has to be applied for. We since intervened to say, but why must we go into the queue instead of kicking in? Why? Because we have that information. I'm not sure, Chair, whether the debate is about keeping the benefit as is, if it is from the original, not from the. Maybe let me borrow your example: the breadwinner being a wife, and that's a beneficiary in terms of whoever had an accident, we can calculate. But the husband was basically at the end of the husband is no longer the impact. The husband, the wife is not there as a main beneficiary. Then the next thing is going to be family. The same thing, the calculation is no longer the first. It's no longer the qualification period that falls away. And the set, I think it's a D or in terms of the beneficiary, the Section 6, another set of payment then kicks in. I don't think the calculation will be the same. I don't think it will be the same. It will be a different set of calculation, in my view. So it's not going to be the same. Should be different. So maybe the explanation can then be the 24.5, and then that will be explained. But I'm just reminding myself about what we discussed yesterday, which in a way is helpful in this discussion on the family support section 3.
Mr. Valemse? Oh, sorry, Mr. Sithole. Nothing? Mr. Sibanda? You're fine. You're okay. Mr. Vellum, sir?
So first deal with the after-tax income. If this benefit is based on the gross, you will be paying an annuity, which would be taxable in the hands of the beneficiaries. So this is on an after-tax amount. It will not be taxed in the hands of the beneficiaries. That's the first thing. In respect of the family support benefit, maybe I'll deal with the discussion yesterday as well. So the automatic provision that we talk about would come up or would apply in an instance for where the beneficiary that dies is in the receipt of a benefit under one or two. In other words, a temporary income support benefit or a long-term income support benefit. So if in that instance that beneficiary dies, the new benefits that now arise is the family support benefits. And depending on the composition of the family, you will have instances where there is no spouse, some where there are multiple spouses, some without children, some with more children, some with other dependents. The various formula here, A, B, C, and on the other page, D and E, deals with the various compositions that you would get in terms of the family composition. So in terms of A, the answer to why are you halving the incomes, the income says, and I'll give it to the actuary, just my colleague, to just give more detail. The current position is that if you quantify a loss of support claim, you allocate two parts per spouse and one part per child. That's the usual approach to quantifying loss of support claims under the current dispensation. It's very similar in this instance, although this now allows for different types of compositions in that you have additional wives or no children and what the position would be. So the formula in A halves the spouse's income and halves the deceased income because it's assumed that both contribute to the household. But I'll leave it there and maybe if I can just fill out the actuarial part of this.
Thank you, Chair, through you. So I think the idea, if I just simplify it, so if there's a household, the husband earns 200,000, the wife earns 100,000. So So the assumption is between the two of them, one gets 150, 150. So then if one dies, the other one then remains with their 150. So that's the principle. That's what's captured in A. So A just takes the household income, which is the 200 plus the 100, divide by 2, and say one share is for the husband, one share is for the wife. And then if the husband dies, they die with their share. The wife remains with their share. Then the second part says, if they have children, then it means that the 300,000 was shared between the spouse as well as the children. So what basically the formula does in B is it reduces the portion. It allocates a portion for each child as well as the spouse. And then so C, comparing A and B, the what you get there is, in the case where there is no children, the spouse gets more. In B, where they have, say, two children, because B, they indicate your number of children, then there is a portion for each child as well as the spouse. And then C tells you the portion that the child gets. And then as we get to D, it's a case where there is no surviving spouse. So basically the formula then says it means the breadwinner's income was shared only among the dependents, all of the children. So they get slightly higher because there was no spouse. And then in E, it then takes in the situation where there were multiple spouses. Again, then it means the share that goes to each spouse is further reduced because there's multiple spouses. I think I can just stop there. Thank you.
Honorable Humsinga.
Chair, I think it would be most helpful if we could maybe also ask by Tuesday, when we are expecting a lot of the feedback, that we also get a layout of a couple of typical scenarios and examples. Because in just looking at the formula, it presents a particular scenario. So if we could maybe judge the application of formula and factor to particular examples, it might be a bit more practical and clear as to which of these would benefit the future claimants and which wouldn't be of benefit and which should be reconsidered for alteration in terms of the formula varieties that we have here. Because if I could just move on, Chair, to C, at the bottom of page 30, you know, there again you have a quarter calculation. So, you know, the same query arises over and over. So I think if we can just generalize and say if it's acceptable to have some examples that one could actually in rands and cents see, because as it was explained now, I sort of can't see why the number of children should penalize a surviving spouse, for instance, to accept less income in circumstances where there are more children in the family opposed to the income which the surviving spouse would get with less children. So some examples would definitely help to understand these better.
Honorable Ramatlakana.
I think the illustration that is called for in terms of looking at dummy figures, because it can only be a dummy situation. So I think it's welcome, we can do that. But I think we should be moving from the premise that under the main document in the sections, cited section here, we have been there before. We have a view already. Some of them have suggested amendments. Some of them have already said, I think this is fine. We're not going to be able to draft a formula that is cast in concrete, that is going to be dependent on the situation that is going to arise, that are going to be confronted with. Because everything here that has been said, some of them is going to be hypothetical. I'm going to say this maybe, but that's not really the case. So I don't think much we'll get much out of that, because we will have adopt at the end of the day when we finalize this act with a schedule in a broad stroke like that with an indication, but the narratives in the bill explain the shorthand here, or the formula if you like, because this is like simply a formula to calculate or to summarize what is contained already in the bill. But the illustration about the case, I think that it can be done. I mean, you can bring a board, something, start writing it. The actuaries in the house can catch that quickly for us to see. But I think for me, I think I'm satisfied with the explanation, because this is the future. We're looking at the future today, and we don't know that future is going to develop with us.
Can we, honourable members, honourable Humsinga?
Thank you, Chair. I think my colleague has summed it up in a way that it would definitely enlighten us to understand the formulas better, and I absolutely go along with that. And I think it's a principle which would pertain to the rest of the formulas as well. So, Chair, I think that would provide us with what we lack at this stage in terms of examples and understanding what Z and X and Z and all of those things stand for.
Can we therefore agree that the Schedule 1, in particular the family support, in totality, we will have to get the guidance as to the formulation of this formula, and maybe have something that is dummy-like, which will be able to inform members more. Can we pass Schedule 1? Can we go to the memorandum of the objects on the road accident benefits scheme?
Yeah.
Okay. This is a summary of what we have been doing. Any other input, honourable members? Honourable Msinga, Honourable Humsinga, Honourable Siabi, you'll follow.
Chair, I would submit that a lot of what stands in here would be subject to what should be changed and was suggested to consider for changes. So therefore, Chair, I would submit that we have dealt with this, although we haven't quite dealt with it, but through implication, all of this would not really be applicable. Thank you.
Honourable, truly so, Honourable Siabi, the memorandum will definitely change big time, so we can only deal with it once we have had all the other things. Honourable Siabi?
He stole my words, but I just wanted to emphasise that on page 33, and I agree with his input, on page 33, 3.61 and so on.
Page 33.
If you look at 3.61 up to 3.65, it tries to address what we corrected before.
Yep.
So that's why I'm saying I just wanted to use that as an example in support of my stolen words.
But you're not injured, be that as it may, even if your words are stolen. Honourable Member, are there other things that we need to deal with? Honourable Ramatlakane, Honourable Siabi, before I go into the agenda item that is written in white ink.
No, Chair, I don't know. I just want to pose a question to try and offload the stuff that is on the parking bay. Yesterday we parked the section, page 13, 31, 32, and 33. I don't know whether we will not just deal with that now and get done with it, then we know that we not don't have a backlog of issues that stand hanging.
I don't see any harm, honourable members, if we deal with the issues that were put in the parking bay so that we can clear, and then there can be fresh air in the parking bay once we have cleared all the goods that were put into the parking bay. I think we had section what? Section 31? 31, 32, 33, which were put in the parking bay. If we can deal with that. But before then, Honorable CRB, you had your hand up. Okay. Can we look at Section 31, Contracted Healthcare Service Providers? Honorable Humsinga.
Thank you, Chair. I don't quite know how we are going to resolve this. Because as I understand it, it's about the determination of tariffs where the Minister of Health and the Minister of Transport need to get together and engage with service providers, on the one hand public service providers and on the other hand private service providers, and then for you to come back and give an indication of the actual cost around this. So I'm not sure how we can help with this process, unless we are just seeking, colleague, to summarize what we have said, you know, should go to the parking bay, as we've put it.
Honorable Ramatlakana.
No, Chair, yesterday the issue about the tariffs, if I just borrow this in terms of 31, was explained. I think there was explained in terms of this act that the tariffs would be determined by the minister, both two ministers. We have then asked that the department or the RAF are using currently certain tariffs, which should form the basis for tariffs that we're talking about going forward. For that one, we said Tuesday would be the time in which they can make a submission on the tariffs. But there were other issues there before that that we talked about. I think we were referred to page 23 of the big document of the department, that there should be some insertion that is derived from that page, the document, the report in this section. Number two, there was an issue about a rephrasing of this section, because as it stands, it was almost like the service provider is expected to provide a fee structure. And it was expected that the service provider would have the information about the cause of death and so on. So we said this must be rephrased, and then I don't know whether that has happened. That's what we said on the 31. If my notes are not deceiving me, but that's what we said. It's an attention. And I think if we agree, and then the Tuesday is the one that is coming, where that can happen, where we can have those kind of drafts. And then there was, let me deal with one by one so that I don't.
Honorable Siari.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I think I would concur with the input of Honorable Ramatlakane. But again, we said we'll need to link or include the Section 217, and as we redraft, try to marry it with the duties of the administrator so that it becomes clear, especially on the issues of procurement. In as much as we say this bill should be pro-poor, even in that area, as we link it with Section 217 of the Constitution, I mean of the PFMA, the Constitution, yes, of the Constitution, we're able to achieve that. Thanks.
Honorable Hunsinger.
Chair, if I could help my colleague there, we also said, if this is then just a summary to just make sure that we have all the bullet points, we also said that we would include under objectives of the Act disputes, and then where that would plug in terms of the appeals process, so we would preferably want to see a process directly approaching the administrator, instead of what is suggested here to only allow an appeals process, so that under the objectives of the Act, that engagement or option of a dispute, that it would link up to the description around the procedure for appeals committee. Then in under Part B, page 15, we picked up the issue around the difference in residence and citizenship, and then around the foreign, foreign refugees, I'm just looking for that particular section, but in the meantime, Chair, there was also, if I could use a phrase that was used yesterday, a lot of bacteria in the clauses, because that's the note I made here, under the duties of the board. Section 15, subsection 7, the A, B, C to D, that portion should also just be looked at. I just made a note there. That's how far I can get, colleagues.
Okay. We were looking for the microscope to look at the bacteria. That is what was said yesterday. Are we agreeing? With respect to clause 31, can we move to clause 32? Non-contracted health services, Honorable Ramatlakana.
Yes, Chair, we spoke about this one, and the general view was that it should be recasted. And particularly there was an issue about the vulnerability of victims of road accident in case that they are not to be blamed when they are picked up at the scene of accident, that by a non-contracted service, that they would not, their mind may not be in a state of knowing that this is non-contracted, and then they will be slapped with the bill. So that we then said we need to recast this so that it reflects. We can't burden the victims with additional funding where the road to accident fund will say this is not, or it's a non-contracted service. So, and then of course we then the rules. On sub 2, we also said that now it was explained today what is going to be the process of getting to the rules. So I think we would look at what the recasting, what the new formulation will look like in terms of those areas on 32.
Any addition on 32? It will be so done. Can we go to individual treatment and rehabilitation plans? Edit taker, Honorable Ramatlakana.
This one, Chair, we did speak about the 33. We did speak about the needs of the victims being paramount, that in the conduct of the administrators, there was an issue about the words that is used about contracted service, that in most cases that the needs of the victims must be paramount. Of the injured person would be the one that administrated and dealing with that person. And then we said what we may have to explain a little bit what the needs of the people who are injured would mean or would encompass. And then I think the first and basic thing that is required, you can explain that the needs here. I think we then ask the state law advisor whether there is a need to do the definition, and she did indicate that we don't need to have a lot of definition, but I think the view is that we should have the definition so that we avoid the misunderstanding around that issue. And that's on 33.
Any taker of 33? I think Honorable Siabi.
In addition, Chair, I think we said as it is reconsidered, we also need to consider that sometimes, especially in the rural areas, you may have contracted service providers but who are not accessible to those who are in the rural areas. So it's something that needs to be looked into. I think is what the Honorable Ramatlakane said, the interest of the victims needs to be taken into consideration.
Okay. Can we agree to that as the crafters will be looking into the proposed amendment, a number of factors that we have spoken to will be taken into cognizance. Any other matter? Honorables, any other matter? We on 33. Can we agree to 33? Okay. Thank you very much. Is there any other matter now that we have finalized 33?
Well,
Honorable Ramatlakane.
Ask that really we get assistance from the secretariat if there is anything else that we packed in the course of dealing with this quite exhausting document, whether there is anything else that we packed that they made note of so that we are able to clear that backlog.
Advocate Nell, Ololitando, Dr. Ngezi.
Chair, on 34, there was just the concern about what constitutes illegal income and how you're going to prove that. That was the one thing that we had to relook. And the distinction between... when you look at the ordinary residence, that's where the residence issue came in. Is it a person that's a citizen or ordinary resident? There were some questions there. Then on 39, I'm just going to run the ones that I have so that we can go to them. 39 was regarding the funeral benefits. Members requested some input from what the RAF is currently paying on average annual for funeral type benefits. Then we had from clause 40, the part E, the review of the benefits, we members indicated that they would like that part E to be moved, either to be under the benefits or move it all the way to general provisions. Also under 39, members, if I can just go back there, the use of the word in respect in 39.1, in respect of funeral of a person. A person is not defined, so is it a person that doesn't have documents that's illegally in South Africa? Are you going to pay for repatriation for those funeral benefits and the other aspects that go with that? if you use a person or citizen, it's just being consistent with the wording that you use throughout the document. Members already touched on the sunset clause concerns, and then the other one was the automatic nomination or beneficiation that has to kick in should the death occur of the beneficiaries.
Nolitando, covered. Dr. Ngezi, covered.
Yes, Chair.
Honorable members, those were the issues which actually were put in the parking bay. The parking bay is now clear. Can we adjourn the meeting?
Check.
Oh, yeah. I'm just checking.
What's the weather, Wick? No, Chair, can I ask that I know before we went for that long break, there was exchange over the table, across the table, about what is repealable and what is not repealable.
Yeah.
I want to make a request that the DOT as well as the DOT, in the RAF Act, because if there is certain section that we can repeal in that Act as it stands that are going to be superfluous as a result of this new Act, we would need to have a schedule at the back indicating Section A, Section D, Section that is repealed henceforth, that you work out around some of those issues that you can then present to us on Tuesday, which section. I mean, for an example, I can make just a simple example. You have the board. You're going to have, you're saying the board moves over. So you can't remain with a continuing with another parallel board that remain live in the Act that is no longer in utilization. So we've got to repeal that. So let us see which section can we repeal and which section remains because of the drag along, the effect of carrying forward with the other implications. It's not a lot of work. I'm sure it's doable, because I think certain sections we must be able to deal with that as we move on. That's all I wanted to say, Chair, and I think the eye contact here seems to be in the positive.
Advocate Makat.
I've got nothing further to say, Chairperson, other than we note the discussions. But then just that I'm clear, I thought that with regard to the transitional provision, based on the discussions and the explanations that were provided, it's settled. That's how I understood it.
Honorable Ramatakar, I'm trying to think.
It was an incorrect advocate. We were disrupted by break when we were still interacting. And that's why I'm bringing it up, that perhaps having understood certain elements of the explanation, there are other areas that you're not going to need that can be then repealed. We'll be adding as a schedule at the back of the new bill as you go forward. So you're not yet off the hook in terms of another kind of groundwork that you must do.
Okay. Honorable Siabi.
I think what was a bit settled was the 2030.
2030 National Development Plan.
Out of the explanation, but I think the suggestion is after explaining, there are other issues that can be seen to be repelled. So let's come up with those so that we are guided accordingly.
Okay. I think that one is very clear. You'll have to look into what can remain, what can remain, and then we move on from there. Honorable members, before we call it a day, let me indicate that we have cancelled tomorrow's meeting in view of the fact that we're going to continue with what we did tonight. Long live, honorable members, long live. The other thing is that in view of the fact that on Tuesday, plenary is going to be starting at 10 o'clock, we will not have our meeting on Tuesday, and our meeting will be moved to Wednesday. So I beg your pardon, honorable member?
Sarice, in the morning, I assume?
Yes. It's Wednesday morning. That's when we will hold our meeting. So it will give us and give also the legal advisors and the department ample of time to can be able to consider what we did in the past 2 weeks as we're dealing with the bill. Thank you, honorable members. Thank you, parliamentary staff. Thank you. Thank you, the Department of Transport. Honorable members, just want to establish with you if you will be available for Thursday so that maybe we can be able to make a submission to request that we continue meeting on Thursday. Once you have checked your diary, please interact with Mayor Carlson, Valerie, so that you can be able to indicate, so that we're able to know as to how can we schedule. I know that Thursday is party caucus. It's committee day. Thursday is committee day. Oh, okay. Just indicate with Valerie those who will be available so that we're able to, by close of business tomorrow, we should be able to have applied to the House Chair for our meeting to continue on Thursday next week. Having said so, the meeting is adjourned, and enjoy your weekend.